My conversation with Sudhir Kakkar took place 5 weeks before his untimely death on April 22nd. In this opportunity, I had to spend time with him in preparing for this interview. I had a sense of how considerable were his intellectual and his personal gifts. As this brief glimpse into his ethos reveals, his death is a profound loss for our profession and his community. He will be missed by both.
Freud, I must say, is very brave and courageous to accept that the world is inadequate and that my desires will never be sufficiently fulfilled. But my question is, but is this in fact the case? I think that everyone has had some kind of spiritual experience, some more than others, and in many different contexts, not just religious ones. And spiritual experiences contradict Freud's notion of common unhappiness and the idea of the world as inadequate. So what reason do we have to assume that all such common experiences are simply false, that they are based on some kind of false consciousness? Rather, I believe that the inadequacy lies with our own awareness rather than with the world, that the world allows for many experiences that would be entirely adequate, yet we block them. What we call the mundane world is, what you just said, much more enchanted than we think it is.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. We've been talking to elders in our field, people who've been practicing for 50 plus years, and they share with us how they view this field evolving and where they see it going. We also talk to clinicians who had professions prior to becoming psychoanalysts, and they share with us their journeys to doing what they now love. These are just samplings of the psychoanalysts we've been talking with, again, from all corners of the globe. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Sudhir Kakkar. He is a psychoanalyst, scholar, and writer living and working in India. And our conversation today is about his decades-long research into the very nature of psychoanalysis and how it is influenced by the soil in which it is born, whether it be from Vienna, the Western culture of Judeo-Christian tradition, or the Indian Hindu culture, which he calls the Hindu-Indian imagination. And we flesh out what those similarities and differences are in psychoanalysis when it relates to these two different cultures. He is gracious enough to share his own personal journey, beginning with his adolescent youth when he was quite smitten by Freud and Western thought, to now in his 80s, where he says he has returned to the childlike pleasures of Hindu enchantment. And we learn something about the journey along the way. He also shares with us at the end a really very dear origin story, how he became a psychoanalyst. He was supposed to be an engineer, as he will recount. And then he met Erik Erikson. And as he will share with us, he had an experience with Erik Erikson where he discovered within himself, I want to be like him. Sudhir Kakkar is very widely published. He's also a visiting professor at multiple universities, Chicago, McGill, Harvard, Melbourne, Hawaii, Vienna. He's on the board of the Freud Archives. He's received multiple awards. And the one that stood out to me on this long list, including the MacArthur Research Fellowship, by the way, he was, in 2005, he was called a psychoanalyst of civilizations by the French Weekly. And he was listed as one of the world's 25 major thinkers. He is, as I say, the author and editor of 20 books of nonfiction and 6 novels, and his books have been translated into 22 languages. I learned a great deal from reading a number of his works and having the pleasure of meeting him and discussing with him. I suspect you will find it, as to use his word, as enchanting as I did. Here is my conversation with Sudhir Kakkar. Sudhir, welcome. I'm so glad to have you. A challenge for psychoanalysis today is for us to consider in what ways cultural factors embody themselves in the unconscious minds of our patients. And we know that these different ways of thinking and perceiving in different cultures are transmitted intergenerationally through the unconsciouses of parents and caretakers. And if we pause for a moment to think about it, it won't be surprising to recognize that different psychoanalytic cultures even consider this psychoanalytic question differently. And you've noted this throughout your writings, that you find that in the West, there are some analysts who emphasize the importance of class and race in the internal lives of patients. Whereas in India, you note, in contrast, that the objects of curiosity in this realm are more oriented towards civilizations and society. And we're going to discuss the similarities and differences between a psychoanalysis, Western psychoanalysis, that was grounded and born in Judeo-Christian soil, as contrasted with Indian psychoanalysis and the soil in which it lives, which, as you've pointed out, includes branches in the natural world and the mystical world. And we're going to follow the evolution of your thinking from what you call your Hindu-Indian imagination to your psychoanalytic, if we will, imagination, and, as I read it, back to your Hindu-Indian imagination. And we're going to learn about your thinking and enrich our own thinking by doing that. We're also going to close with this marvelous origin story that you've shared with me about what was the beginnings and how you got into becoming a psychoanalyst. To start us off, we'll start at the beginning of life, and we're going to take selections from various of your writings, and they're quite extensive. This is from a chapter called Psychoanalysis and Its Disquiets, A View from India, and you write, "You wonder whether ego formation is different in India, where urban area breastfeeding continues for over a year for children of both genders at a rate of 79%, compared to the United States, where extended breastfeeding rates are around 6%. From breastfeeding, the Indian child proceeds to not spoon feeding, but to hand feeding, less frequently to strollers, than being carried on the mother's side or back in skin contact, and extended co-sleeping with parents or elder relatives." Start us off. Tell us what you mean to be fleshing out in that representative example.
Thank you for having me here, Harvey. I'm glad to be here and to chat about our common interests. And my major point was that what I missed in psychoanalysis and still continue to, although it has been changing recently, is the role of cultural imagination in the formation of the psyche.
Help me, I couldn't hear what you said. What imagination?
The cultural
imagination. Yes, got it. Okay.
In the in the formation of the psyche. Uh-huh. And by cultural imagination, I mean not just myths and legends and stories and admonitions of parents, children, vistas they hold for their children, what is a good life, what is a good society, but very concretely also of how a child is or a baby is fed, carried. So all that comes into the formation of the cultural imagination. That role of cultural imagination has not been, as you also pointed out, it is changing, but it is changing in the sense of race and class, because that is important for Western societies, that is important. But not all these kind of things, which I call the civilizational ones, they are not considered. Partly, I think, and they were not seen as important by the Western theorists. Partly, I imagine, also because of the how could they know about the Indian cultural imagination or the cultural imagination of other non-Western culture? Since both the patients and the analysts came from the same kind of stock, as it is commonly said, if fish were scientists, then the last thing they would discover would be the water.
Right, right.
So I think this water has not been really discovered. I think it has started. Psychoanalysts are getting more and more oriented towards that. So, and this was the start of the thing of the orientation. And that also that it extends deep into the psyche. It is not an epiphenomena. It is not something which comes late in life, and that's why I talked about that, whether the ego formation is already there, the cultural part of the psyche. And that the cultural imagination or culture is one part of the mental representation. That's what cultural imagination means, the mental representations of a culture which we grow up in, which is, of course, mediated by the individual's family. So it changes according to region and how the family transmits it. But there is a common core, and which makes it quite different from the what I call the Western transmission, which has a Judeo-Christian roots. It has Judeo-Christian roots.
You bring up the Christian roots, which is a lovely segue, because we're going to use your relationship to Hinduism as the template with which to feel our way through these differences. And I want to move us to, you have a book called Religion and Spirituality, and I want to read a few segments from a couple of chapters and ask you to spend your time with it. And you begin us at the beginning for you. You write, when you were 18 years old, quote, "I came across Freud's writing and took my first steps into the world of Western ideas and imagination. I cannot pretend that I understood everything I consumed so voraciously. I sensed, though, that in my inner world I was being gently guided away from my native Hindu-Indian imagination, full of myths and marvels, infused with romantic longing, into an iconoclastic way of seeing the world where, if one looked hard and deep enough, all gods have clay feet. The experience was exhilarating." Now, on the very next page of this chapter, you write, "Decades later, no longer resonating with Nietzsche's call that every past is worth condemning, questioning my earlier idealization of Western civilization and the Judeo-Christian tradition of which psychoanalysis, in spite of some differences in its image of man, is an integral part, I come back to Freud with some of the skepticism of the great skeptic himself." Now, we just represented bookends on your life story, from the beginnings to the beginnings of idealization to later de-idealization, to characterize it too succinctly. Help us understand your journey.
Well, the journey, I think, is not difficult to understand, because As an 18-year-old, I was primed to not rebel, but to start questioning all the received wisdom of the Indian Hindu tradition of what good society is, what a person's goals in life are, what a person should be. And reading Freud was an experience of liberation, of aha, that this may not be so at all. So that is the liberation. And of course, to discover that you can question that all gods have clay feet was a very, very exhilarating experience for an 18-year-old, even if you couldn't say it out aloud in the family, etc. So this of course, combined with also Marxism of that age, of the young ones, which also is the opiate of the masses. So it was the de-idealization of my Hindu past and Hindu tradition. And what Freud offered was a very new, fresh vista. So that was, as I said, not only an exhilarating, but a very freeing kind of experience. Uh-huh. Later on, of course, much, much later on, let me put it that way, slowly I started questioning also whether it really, what are the gains and what are the losses there? What are involved? I mean, decades later, I would say, so no longer resonating with the Nietzsche's call that every past is worth condemning.
Yeah, that's a great phrase.
Yeah. So questioning my earlier idealization of Western civilization and the Judeo-Christian tradition, as we were talking about, of its psychoanalysis, in spite of its differences in its image of man, in its also differences in the national Western, say the French, American, the Argentinian, and they all have differences, but they are all part of that Judeo-Christian tradition. So as I said, reading Freud's of an illusion at a later stage of life, and self-consciously as a member of a non-Western cultural group, so I was struck by how Freud's analysis of religion is inescapable, is very much tied to Judeo-Christian beliefs on what is God, is there a God at all, and which is at least on Hindu tradition, there is many, many doubts about that. And also, which I think maybe come back to later, what I started missing was probably my own the child in me, which started becoming more and more insistent, started missing the enchantment of Hindu religious beliefs and Hindu religion and the marvels and the illusions. So illusions was not a bad word at all for me then later on, and that maybe it is something what we need, or re-enchantment is something which is also needed at some stage of life. It cannot be the child's early child, but let's say remnants of it, or a new form of it, is perhaps important to not a full life, but at least a creative, interesting life. So, as I was saying, as this became more and more important to me, the de-idealization of Freud continued. It doesn't mean that complete the rejection of Freud. In fact, in many ways, Freud became more important in some ways. But that is a different Freud.
Yeah.
Strives to be a positivist scientist at all, who writes that he's actually a writer of fiction, that he would love to be a fiction writer, or
as are you,
an artist.
Yes. Let me emphasize some of the particulars you have noted in your writings about the differences. You write, you use Freud's own methodology in this chapter, you become an interlocutor. And so you talk to him and you write, quote, "When you assert that the primal father was the original image of God, the model on which later generations have shaped the figure of God, or when you call religion the universal obsessional neurosis of humanity, which, like the obsessional neuroses of children, arose out of the Oedipus complex, out of the relation to father. Your whole construction of the idea of God arising from the constellation of the helpless child and the protective father, who is also a source of danger and ambivalence, you claim is deeply imprinted in every religion, though it seems to be absent or at least insignificant in Hindu religious imagination. At best, it is but a minor theme in a grand symphony." And this is an important distinction that you've focused on. So can you tell us a little bit about how narrow Freud's vision was, you feel, about different religious beliefs?
Well, I'd have to really not elaborate on it too much. I think the narrowness of the vision comes from Freud's emphasis on the father as a model, as the primal father, as a model for God or belief in God. Mm-hmm. So the father becomes a very, very important part of the explanation for existence of God or the belief in God. Let me put it that way. Now, this is not true at all of Hindu religion. The father gods, the father gods, the creator Brahma. He's the only one with a gray beard, for instance. And he has only one temple in all of India dedicated to him. There are hundreds of temples to mother goddess and the other gods. Let me put it, the face of the creator, destroyer, and preserver. Those are the three of them. They are very, very remote figures. Nobody wish people respect them, but not really. They're not close to the heart of most of Hindu Indians, where mother goddesses play a very, very big role. There are temples in every village for mother goddesses. Also, and the protector, which Freud attributes to the father god, is a completely absent in the in the Hindu tradition, where the protector are the combined parents, parental image, not the father image. So whenever you talk of a father god, say Krishna, so it would be Radha Krishna's consort. It would be Sita Ram. Sita is the consort of Ram. So they would be always mentioned together, not as a separate, not Ram, not Krishna, and the other one. So that is certainly one big difference. So the whole idea of Father God becomes very, very difficult to explain to a Hindu India and then the major part, of course, is how does one relate to God? If you say, or the divine, let me put it, the divine, because God may become a sexist term with it. So how does one relate to God? And then there is mentioned and is done that there are 6-7 ways of relating to God. So God as your child, that are all the children, God, Krishna, Rama, as children. So they are worshipped as children. I mean, or their relationship to them is as children. In fact, at the moment, I don't know if you read that, there's a huge temple which was constructed. I mean, it has completely moved and is playing a very, very big role in awareness. Is the temple to child Ram, not the...
Right. Mm-hmm.
So the child is extremely vivid. So that is one. Then God is lover. That is Krishna, Radha. So that one can think of God or have a relationship to God as lover. Then God as as a servant to God, that one serves God. But in all those another three or four ways of relating to God, awe is completely absent. Thou shalt fear is a completely absent emotion in how one relates to God, which is also a very, very big difference, say, with the Judeo-Christian is putting it. But I mean, all, let's say, the monotheistic faith, whether in Islam, Judaism, or in Christianity, yes, there's a loving God, but there's also a God of who smites and smotes, and which is an absent kind of a thing in the Hindu Indian tradition.
Let me ask you a question about that. I read that and was fascinated to hear what you had to say. Some years ago, I was visiting India and was taken around by a guide who we got talking about such matters, and he said he doesn't believe in any of the gods, was very knowledgeable about it, and he took us into a temple. And before he walked into the temple, he did some gesture that seemed, I don't recall exactly the gesture, but it was something one did apparently before you walked into a temple. And I said, help me understand, you just finished telling me you didn't believe in the God, but you did the gesture. And he said, well, just in case I'm wrong, you know, it doesn't hurt. And we all laughed. And one of the reasons we laughed is that you hear people in the Judeo-Christian community say the exact same kind of things. Yeah, I don't believe in God, but yes, I'll do this ritual or that ritual because, you know, you can never be too careful. So there is that similarity. And how does that fit in with what you're sharing?
Yeah, there is that similarity, but the whole Indian tradition, you don't have to believe in God at all.
Yes, that's
for
what
instance,
I learned.
In Hinduism, yeah. In fact, the supposed to be the highest, not the scriptures, let's put the highest religious books, the Upanishads, there is no mention of the major goal of how to attain, well, let me put transcendence, mystical experience, or what are the kind of meditations you need to do. There is no mention that there of God in any of those. And that goes further. The idea of God or gods comes much, much later, or almost 15 years after the major Hindu scriptures are done, where it is just, what do you do to have that religious feeling, that mystical feeling, what are the exercises needed, etc., but without any mention of God. Now, this person you are mentioning, I think, is much more in the modern tradition of the kind. Like, right. It doesn't say, it doesn't hurt. He's covering his bases. Yes, the Indian tradition says a thing, but the other people who say that may not be so. So let's cover bases. Fine.
Right.
But there is no feeling of guilt about it. If you don't believe in God at all in the Hindu tradition. In fact, you can be a Hindu and an atheist. It says not at all.
That's what I learned. You write, for example, that rituals and practice take precedence over belief. And you say a Hindu is as a Hindu does. And I was intrigued by that because many people have pointed to similarities between the Hindu and Jewish traditions. But it is well known that many Jewish people act similarly. That is, that if you ask a Jewish person, are they religious? Their answer has nothing to do with their belief. It has to do with how many of the rituals they do or don't practice. And it has nothing to do with whether you believe in a God or not. And that's a commonality. Let me read a piece that you wrote about that. You write, the future of an illusion is not necessarily a mistake, but contains partial truths that cannot be universalized. From a Hindu perspective, its major deficiency lies in its basic premise, the importance Freud attaches to religious beliefs and ideas in his portrayal of religious man. Hinduism, though not indifferent to this aspect of religion, certainly considers it much less relevant than religious experience, whether in ritual, religious celebration, pilgrimage, or in mystical experience. For a Hindu, It is the arresting, transformative moments in religious practice that constitute the core of the religion. Perhaps Freud, the novelist, you quote him as saying, in my mind, I always construct novels, and the artist, he said, I am really by nature an artist. My books, in fact, more resemble works of imagination than treatises on pathology. Rather than the positive scientist of the future of an illusion, he would have agreed with that. That was really a revelation to me about the belief is not primary, but the experience and the rituals practice over the lifespan.
Yes, I think first that similarity with the Jewish part of the practice is the much more important. So it becomes very, very important, I think, as in, I don't know, not so much familiar. Well, I know some of it. I have Jewish friends and all. For instance, what you can eat and what you cannot eat.
Right.
And when you can eat and when you cannot eat. So much more attention is paid to those kind of things, ways of eating. Also, what time you should eat. So all those kind of practices, and whether one should call them religious practices or Jewish identity practices,
rituals. Yes.
So rituals. So they become important. And what one is looking for in the rituals in the Indian part, and I'm not sure, but I imagine also for the Jewish, is not just a ritual for their own sake, but they have their transformative moments. They connect you to your past. They connect you to your life, not to your this mundane day-to-day life, but they take you out of it for a while, for that short while. So the transformative experiences which you get in the rituals is much, much more important than belief of the cosmogony, or how God came to be, who's God, and who are its, the whole belief system, the dogmas, and the institutions.
You go on in this book, you discuss specifically your evolution, and I'd like to read a piece from that because and then ask to discuss it. You say, mine was an effort to use psychoanalytic theory to understand Hindu family life and imagination. This began with my own analysis in Germany. Consciously, I was very much into an idealization of psychoanalysis and of analysts, but in some ways, I was already feeling that there is something lacking in psychoanalysis. In the beginning, it was an Indian's encounter with psychoanalysis, but comparisons quickly followed. I soon became aware that psychoanalysis is centered on the individual as compared with so many other cultures, especially mine. I found myself both questioning the Indian worldview from a psychoanalytic perspective and vice versa. Eventually, I came to believe that the two are not opposites. It is not a question of either or, but rather a question of how to combine them. For instance, is one a precursor to the other? I think that the individual-centered approach of psychoanalysis is important, but it is a precursor to the communitarian view of the person. The autonomous individual is the precursor to the caring individual. I have to ask you something about that. You go on, a community-centered orientation alone, without reflection, can become very confining. On the other hand, an exclusively individual-centered way of being is also not a viable person. My own encounter with psychoanalysis was very helpful to me because it made me interrogate the communitarian perspectives that I had grown up with on what constitutes a person and what is a good society. This kind of self-questioning was important for me, as it is for many others in contemporary India. Through this self-interrogation, one becomes more aware of the sacrifices that you have to make in a communitarian Indian culture, but also what the culture gives you that is not available in individual-centered cultures. And you go on to say, there are huge pleasures of individuality to be had, and one should not look down upon them. There are also huge pleasures in being part of a community, and there are huge pains in both. Well, there's a lot in that. Let me start us off by this sentence you write. The autonomous individual is the precursor to the caring individual. Help me understand that.
That the autonomous individual is the goal, or let's say the ideal of what someone undergoing psychoanalysis should become. And that means an individual with choices which are not being affected by all the debris of growing up in childhood, etc.
Oh, autonomous from one's past debris. I understand. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now the thing is that enough? Because at least my small experience shows that often it becomes the autonomous individual becomes a very narcissistic individual. I, me, mine becomes the most important part. Yes, I, me, mine is needed, but to stop at that is for me, I think, a somewhat a doubtful virtue of what psychoanalysis represents. Now, I'm not saying that everyone does that. I mean, obviously, one should become the result of psychoanalysis. It should be to make you much more tolerant, much more caring. But that is never really spelled out. And that's why I was saying that is only a precursor to be the caring individual. And for that to come in, psychoanalysis, some psychoanalysis theories part really need looking at again of what is a person, what is the model of a person, what does a person consist of, and I think psychoanalysis has been constrained by looking at the person only as a part of her bodily order and her interpersonal order, starting from the family, that it is constrained by those two and misses out a whole part, according to me, of what I've later called the cosmic order. Now, the cosmic order doesn't mean, or people say the spiritual order, but spiritual is such a word, it is such antipathy, reflexive antipathy among psychoanalysts that I would rather use existential rather than spiritual. I think existential may be more acceptable to psychoanalysis. And by that I mean, well, just leaving aside the spirit, which is sacred, divine, this, that, just the material aspects, the earthy aspects of the spiritual order, and which is nature, for instance, seasons, sunlight, all which surrounds us, which we are part of it. So we are part of the natural order, which is part of the cosmic order. So that part has not been stressed enough, or very perhaps need to expressly acknowledge and put into as that the whole person is not only body and mind and psyche, but also nature, and which then also one can talk of what is called the spiritual or the existential. That is the, and that would then automatically become the autonomous individuality is not the goal, but the caring person is the goal. Someone who cares for around you, and not only you.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting the words you use, because as you may know, at least in the West, I don't know outside of it, there's a great deal of interest in psychedelic treatments. I'm not talking about the abuse of them. I'm talking about the careful integration of them into a therapy. And the words you use are so similar to the words that people who have been through that use, where they feel themselves in relation to the world around them, the natural world, the spiritual world, if you wish, And they do find it transformative, very much in the way you're saying.
Glad to hear that. I must say I was not associated with it, but I shared the same office floor with Timothy Lear at Harvard in 1965. So when the whole psychedelic
was building up. Uh-huh.
Yes.
Yeah. All right.
64 in William James Hall. So, but it was far away from him, because that was too far out in those days. But I'm glad that it is now coming back in a very different way. It was also looked at as transformative at that time also. But then it became not transformative, but a cult of experience only, and not just of something, not the careful part which is being done now. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah. I want to go back to what you've said about how Freud remains important to you and what ways he does and what ways he doesn't. You write, Freud becomes less important in one way, and then he becomes more important in another, and everyone has his or her own Freud. Much of Freud no longer is important to me. Really, just the four essentials remain: the existence of a dynamic unconscious, the importance of early childhood, unconscious conflict, and the notions of transference and countertransference. At first, I connected mainly with Freud's emphasis on what is hidden, such as the hidden significance of dreams. But now, this isn't as important to me as Freud's emphasis on introspection and reflection on the examined life. I also came to think that if psychology tells you mainly about unhappiness, as does Freud's, it is not enough for most people's needs. Freud offers too little emotionally. I'm inclined to believe that awareness of a much wider reality, what I refer to as the cosmic order, allows for a more meaningful vision of life and human possibility, one that is not restricted to common unhappiness. I have one question I want to ask you about this, which is when you say different parts of Freud are important to you now, do you mean that you find them more useful clinically? That's the nature of how they're important, or do you find them important to you more in a vision of living a life?
Both, I think. Both. Certainly of living a life. But also clinically in the sense that, of course, people come clinically, they come for to be healed from depression, mm-hmm. anxiety, and whatever. That is something which you are not going to avoid. But how does this come into Freud's introspection, importance of introspecting, living the examined life, is also being much much quieter oneself as a therapist in the thing of. Which of course many analysts do, that let's discover together what is needed. That the healing part of psychoanalysis is a byproduct of knowing oneself, of reflection, of introspection. That becomes much more central to my way of thinking than a focus on the what is to be healed. Depression, anxiety, etc.
Is that similar to the idea that what one hopes to gain post-analytically is the capacity to self-analyze rather than this or that particular content that is discovered or rediscovered?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I want to read another piece about, again, how you distinguish one type of psychoanalysis from what could be an Indian approach to psychoanalysis. You write, if there is or could be an Indian approach to psychoanalysis, it would need to see the person as not only part of the social order or polis, but also as part of a cosmic order. This is where the Indian or Hindu approach has been the most emphatic. Psychoanalysis made great progress in moving from the bodily order to the relational order. But the relational is still limited to human beings and family. It does not extend beyond that in contemporary psychoanalysis. An Indian approach would reach beyond human relations, such as in the family and kinship groups, to nature. Also, it would extend to the cosmic realm and thus to the spirit. Precisely how this would look, I'm not sure. Typically, when we conduct therapy, the therapist's third ear opens when there is talk of mother and father. Otherwise, it largely remains closed. How might we integrate the cosmic dimension into mainstream psychoanalytic practice? I don't precisely know. Well, that is the question, isn't it? How does one, operationalize working outside of the human dimension? A question I have about this is, when you say the analyst ears pick up when we hear mother and father, what I understand you to be referring to is that the analyst ears pick up when we discern, either verbally or otherwise, that there's something sort of infantile, obviously not in a pejorative sense, but very young in a way of thinking in a patient's mind that's emerging. And that's the soil we work on, the early perceptions and fantasies. The cosmic order isn't in the world order. The child's cosmic order is the mother. That's the child's cosmic world for a very long time.
Right.
And so in suggesting that we look at the cosmic order apart from it as a mother, what is it to the infant child that we're treating?
The thing is, if we looked at the cosmic order, let's look at nature, for instance, as only a much later part, and that yes, the mother is at the beginning of life, the cosmos for the child. But it isn't that the rest of the creation is completely absent from the child's perception. The birds, the sunlight, seasons, that they have no effect on the child at all. It is only the mother and nothing else is something I quite doubt. Now, of course, that the mother is the most important part of the cosmos at that particular age, but that all the rest is absent. It may be because we are taught that that is so.
Okay, fair enough.
That it doesn't exist, that the mother is the only one. So I would say that once we start looking at nature much more, in fact, something which I'm not jokingly would say, but if psychoanalysis had started in India and not in cold European, North European countries, where it is conducted in closed rooms with the heating on, where there no nature comes in at all, would be very, very different psychoanalysis than the ones, which the Indian gurus or spiritual teachers conducted their classes or their disciples, which was always in the open under trees. So you would have much more of nature there coming in if psychoanalysis had a different start of that kind.
Point taken. And in fact, I'm glad you mentioned the juxtaposition of spiritual teachers and psychoanalysis, because I want to read something that you wrote of a personal sort and ask you about it. You write, "Like many people deprived of sight who develop acute oral or tactile perceptions, the emphasis on words in the analytic situation, I believe, increases the patient's and the analyst's sensitivity to the nuances and particularities of language. At least that has been my own experience. When in the full throes of transference during my training analysis in Germany, I not only began to dream in German, but also to write fiction in that language, a gift that was snatched away when the analysis ended. The enhanced linguistic sensitivity receded when the transferential context, which had made it possible, disappeared." The next sentence you write in the next paragraph is, "Compared to the analyst, then, the spiritual teacher is relatively uninhibited, but also more endangered, in employing the full register of communication to convey his empathic understanding of the patient seeker's internal state." Now, I read that carefully, and I was moved by your sharing that profound experience in your analysis. But it seemed to me that you used a shorthand when you said that the gift of language was snatched away when the analysis ended and that the transferential context disappeared. That's a shorthand because we know that transference doesn't disappear. It's always in us, in modified and sublimated forms, hopefully, but it's always with us. That your next sentence is about, compared to the analyst, then the spiritual teacher is relatively uninhibited. It sounded to me that you were manifestly or latently suggesting that there's a displacement, that remnant transference from our analyses can then shift onto spiritual teachers and carry the same meaning and energy that either was or wasn't as thoroughly dealt with as it might have been. Does that seem correct to you?
I think you're correct that disappearing is a much too strong a word. As it recedes or it becomes lesser in its effect, it's never completely disappears. But I think that language part was another way of, not another way of saying, but that Indian approach to psychoanalysis, which you were talking of earlier, would have this another way of, which is that that it is that an analysis is primarily conveyed through verbalized interpretation, so that the analyst's communication of empathy for the patient's inner state is primarily through words. So other means of communication, oral, visual, tactile, olfactory senses, have received really very limited attention in analytic literature. Although analysts have long known that it is these other non-verbal means and not words which constitute the fundamental layer of human communication in infancy, since we were talking about that.
We're learning that more and more, as a matter of fact. Do you think it's fair to consider that the what we call an analytic transference is the foundation of the attachment to the spiritual leader?
The foundation, of course, I think, which we discussed earlier, is the mother, the maternal cosmos, the mother universe. And then, of course, then the maternal transference is the one which goes towards the spiritual teacher also, because the spiritual teachers are almost never as father figures. Mm-hmm. They have a very maternal kind of, and I've talked of that way. Now, Gandhi, for instance, who was called Bapu, for father by others, always wished to, told all his people, disciples who came to him, etc., that he's the mother, he's not the father at all. So the mother part is such an important part. I mean, I think it's important everywhere, but it is emphasized so much, which I call the maternal enthralment in the Indian case, is emphasized so much. So that is the... that is the way to the spiritual teacher, and that is why the musical aspect or the tone, accent, pauses, silences, intonation, which amplify or belie even the empathy of words. Mm-hmm. So what I call the music of healing is much more from the mother's maternal enthrallment and from the going into the towards the analyst, but it is not only individual. I think it is also cultural, because especially where in India or in many other Eastern civilizations, where the formal mode of communication required within the family, and especially in hierarchical relationships, is the reliance placed on prosody to divine the real meaning of a speaker's words, which may be greater than in cultures which hold that saying what one means and meaning what one says as highly desirable virtues. It is not a desirable virtue in these cultures. So there's all these things, the music of feeling and then the gestures, etc., play a much, much more important role. And it was in that context which I was saying that the psychoanalytic setting has that advantage, though, or at least that plus point of increasing your ear for language or linguistic much, much more. doesn't mean it compensates for the absence of the tactile and the and the oral, you know, but it does compensate for the of the increasing your linguistic sensitivity, and it can under the of course wanting to be loved by the analyst increases tremendously, wanting to be understood by him. So which means if, as in my case, it was a different language I had to speak, I learned that language. Nothing can has come even closer to it so fast that I marvel myself that I could write short stories in German. So that there is an advantage also of the of only in the linguistic part, in the language part, but all the missing of the tactile and the oral and the... So what they call the music and dance of feeling, those are something there which I rather well regret that it is not paid more attention. Let me put it: of course, people pay attention, but not more attention in psychoanalysis. I can imagine the tactile part, which is that has of course had very very bad press because of the
it does.
Of the. Boundary violations of it doesn't stop the boundary violations which I when you read about all the kind of classical figures of or major figures of the psychoanalytic canon and history indulging in it, but at least it has had a very chilling effect on the tactile part.
You're calling for, it seems to me, more enchantment in the psychoanalytic work, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Is that a fair representation of what you're also saying?
Yes. I think I start with quoting Keats there, that that it is very difficult to accept, which Freud, I must say, is very brave and courageous, to accept that the world is inadequate and that my desires will never be sufficiently fulfilled. But my question is, what is this in fact the case? I think that everyone has had some kind of spiritual experience, some more than others, and in many different contexts, not just religious ones. And spiritual experiences contradict Freud's notion of common unhappiness and the idea of the world as inadequate. So what reason do we have to assume that all such common experiences are simply false, that they are based on some kind of false consciousness? Rather, I believe that the inadequacy lies with our own awareness rather than with the world, that the world allows for many experiences that would be entirely adequate, yet we block them. What we call the mundane world is what you just said, much more enchanted than we think it is.
Yeah. I want to make sure we have time to include your origin story, how you became a psychoanalyst. Would you share that with our listeners? Because it's lovely.
Yes, I would. I've related that story often because I take such great pleasure in it.
I know you do, yeah.
Well, I came back from Germany after 5 years. I'd studied engineering first in India and then went to Germany to work in a shipyard, where I discovered that I don't want to be an engineer at all, because that was supposed to be those days in the late 50s. Engineering and doctors, medicine were the only professions. Doctors I couldn't be because I fainted at the sight of blood, so engineer I was supposed to be. And when I came back, but in Germany, I completely discovered the world of art and artists and writers and movies. The world completely opened up to me from where I had been. So when I came back and started working in an institute of management, I was completely at loss. I missed Germany tremendously. I didn't know what to do. At one time, I wanted to be a film director. Didn't know how to be, where to get that kind of education. So I was completely confused, completely confused. And then what happened was that where I was living, in my aunt's house, there was a guest house, and Erik Erikson had come to work on his book on Gandhi, Gandhi's Truth, which was published as Gandhi's Truth, I think in 1969 or 1970, which I think was a very successful book in the U.S. also, Pulitzer Prize and National Book Award, etc., etc. So he would come in the evenings and would discuss what he had been interviewing people and worked. So we talked of Gandhi, and I would talk of my confusion and I didn't know what to do. And he would listen gravely. And actually, that's what I only wanted was to be listened to. Now, I didn't know he was a famous man. I knew what I'd heard about Erich Fromm, but not Erich Erikson. And so when he was going away, or he'd gone away, he had gone from Ahmedabad, where this institute was, which is about 1,500 miles or something from Delhi. And I discovered that evening when he had left that I wanted to be what he is. And so I was very, very lucky that he was listening so gravely to me and seriously. Or in short, I was having an identity confusion and could talk to the person without knowing, was the man who had coined the term identity confusion or identity diffusion. So the Ford Foundation, which had financed the institute, had a representative there. And they were like viceroy at that time. He had come with his own private plane to inspect the institute. And he was going back because I couldn't reach Delhi in time. Erikson would have left for the U.S. next morning. So I went up to him and said, could I take a lift to Delhi with new plane? He said, yes, come. So I went to Delhi and at 11 o'clock landed up in his hotel room, knocked at his door. And he opened the door and he was so surprised to see me because he just said goodbye to me. And he said, what do you want? And I said, well, I've come to the realization that I want to be like you, a writing analyst, or a psychoanalyst, really. And he said, come in. It is to his credit that he didn't laugh out aloud. But he said, but you've never studied psychology before. And I had to admit, no, I hadn't. He smiled and said, doesn't matter, neither have I. Now, he had only a high school diploma. At least I had university degrees, though not in psychology. And he had become a wandering artist and then had landed up at Freud's household and taught Freud's grandchildren art and became then a child analyst, and from then Vienna came to U.S. and then was, let me go. So he said, well, but you have, I have read your short stories and you are psychologically minded. And that is actually what I think is all that is required in the training of becoming an analyst is psychological mindedness. All the rest is not that important. I think he was also pointing to his own that training or the lack of it. So he said, well, go and do your doctorate as fast as possible, and then you can come and be my assistant at Harvard and teach me my course, The Human Life Cycle. So I resigned my post, went off to Vienna to do my doctorate in economics. So that's where my doctorate is from, economics. And came to Harvard, and I must say he kept his promise, which was very, very surprising. Now I'm very surprised at it. I mean, here is a confused young man from a very different culture, and why should he really care? But he kept, and so I was one of the sectionmen in his course on the human life cycle. It was a hugely successful course. 700 or 800 seniors in that big hall could take that course, and then those sectionmen, 6 or 7 of us, would take twice a week sections of 20-30 people and go through all the readings, which of course he didn't have time to go through. So, and I would of course read them all very, very thoroughly, and in fact learned to my initial psychology by teaching it. So, and again, It was a very fast learning. And so one of my discoveries at that time really is that with whatever you call transference, love, it can really, if it goes deep enough, increase your capacity for taking in insight much, much more than the idea which most modern universities have, that it is just the critical thinking which is important. Yes, critical thinking is important after you have imbibed everything or received everything from teacher, guru, mentor, whoever you want to call it. Then critical thinking. So you kill the teacher on the way when you meet him. The Zen saying is after you have taken in. Not critical thinking right from the beginning. You don't want to kill your teacher right from the beginning. Or at least I don't, because I think I got much more from identification with the teacher, mentor, rather than the critical part.
Love has to precede cognition.
Love has to precede cognition. Exactly right.
Yes. Sudhir, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for the pleasure I've had in reading your works. They're listed in the notes, and I can't go through them all, but I've read many of them, and they're really profound and important. And they do just what you just said. It's not that you ignore critical thinking at all, but that it's imbued with a personalness, with a warmth, with a love that makes it a very easy and satisfying to read, but also matches up with what many of us know is the medium of change in analysis. Yes, insight
right.
And concepts are vital, but only after you establish the first premise of connection, attachment, and love.
Right. I think I completely agree with you, Harvey, and thank you very much for inviting me for this podcast. Thanks a lot.
It's been a great pleasure.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.